from KQED.
Welcome to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Nobody wants to be defined by the worst thing that's happened to them. That's a quote from a short film by Chanel Miller. For Miller, that worst thing was a sexual assault, and not to be defined by it has been the hardest journey of her life. Chanel Miller is the woman who was found unconscious behind a dumpster at Stanford in 2015. She was left half naked with cuts and scrapes on her body and pine needles in her hair by then Stanford student Brock Turner, who had sexually assaulted her. Turner was convicted of 3 counts of felony sexual assault, but Judge Aaron Persky sentenced Turner to just 6 months in county jail, of which he served 3. Through the ordeal, Miller was only known as Emily Doe, but now we know her true name, Chanel Miller, and her new memoir is aptly titled, Know My Name. Welcome to Forum, Chanel Miller.
Thank you, Mina. Thank you for having me.
I really liked the way you started your book. It starts with the first 3 words, I am shy, but then you have a little paragraph there that describes exactly what you mean by I am shy. And I was wondering if you wouldn't mind just reading it to us, just that first paragraph.
Sure. I am shy. In elementary school, for a play about a safari, everyone else was an animal. I was grass. I've never asked a question in a large lecture hall. You can find me hidden in the corner of any exercise class. I'll apologize if you bump into me. I'll accept every pamphlet you hand out on the street. I've always rolled my shopping cart back to its place of origin. If there's no more half and half on the counter at the coffee shop, I'll drink my coffee black.
And that's Chanel Miller reading from her memoir, Know My Name. That first paragraph then explains so much about why you responded the way you did when you woke up in the hospital after the sexual assault and were trying to make sense of what had happened to you. Can you describe what was going through your mind and what you began experiencing in that first moment of consciousness?
Sure. My whole life I've been non-confrontational. You know, if someone cuts me in line, I'll let you do it. And I've also prided myself in being self-sufficient and independent. I just graduated and wanted to begin my life as an adult. I didn't want to be instantly derailed. I wanted to continue with the job that I had and to go to work on Monday or Tuesday and continue to do what I was meant to do. I couldn't accept that the reality I was cast into was so different and dark, so I attempted to mute it.
I remember you describing how you apologized to your sister who had been with you the night that you'd been assaulted but had left to take care of a friend briefly, and that's when the assault happened, that you apologized to her for making her worry, and you were trying to assure her that you were okay.
Yeah, I actually think the most painful part of this process has been watching her be in pain. It really hurts to see how it affects your family members to have that suffering reflected back to you. And I felt the urgent need to try and contain that pain, to keep it from leaking out into them, to protect them from it. I had this idea that if I could carry it alone and get through it, then I would spare them. And, you know, I learned over that year and a half that it was impossible to continue without support, that I needed somebody to lean on and to remind me even who I was. I was so disoriented so much of the time and felt entirely stripped of identity. They needed to be there to remind me that I am a person and that I did deserve love. You know, watching my sister go through this process, watching her testify, when I saw that she was being mistreated and attacked, it was instantly clear to me that that was not okay, that that was violating every personal boundary, and I was not going to allow it to continue to happen. And I thought, well, if that applies to her, then it must apply to me too. And I started extending some of that natural self-compassion that I have for her toward myself. So her being there really, really taught me to eventually care for myself and fight for myself.
You mention literally being nameless to a certain extent, and that was how you were described in media reports, in police reports, in other transcripts that were taken about the incident, where you were simply relegated to the word victim each time, and how much that, how jarring that was as you were reading accounts of what happened to you because you didn't know what exactly had happened to you, and that you'd found a lot of these online.
Yeah, I didn't feel like I was ever given any characteristic traits, that I was never suggested that I was surrounded by community or that I had things in my life going for me before this even happened. You know, I talk about, like we were just discussing, how I am shy. You know, I'm naturally introverted. I don't assert myself, and I prefer to observe and listen and absorb. And I think it was interesting that over the course of this year and a half, my trajectory was that I couldn't tolerate anymore. I couldn't tolerate seeing myself as a nameless person. I couldn't tolerate existing in that suffocated, nameless state. It exceeded that capacity to bear it. And so I finally, you know, read the statement, and it was something I never thought I could do, but I realized it's something that happens when you push an introvert to breaking point.
You're talking about your 12-page victim impact statement that you read at Turner's sentencing hearing.
Yes.
And all through that process, you had tried to be what you describe as a good victim. What does that mean?
I felt like I had to keep an even temperament on the stand. I had to be obedient. I had to demonstrate that I was rational in order to be believed. I couldn't be too emotive. You know, even if the defense attorney was really stern or aggressive with me, I had to sit and be polite and continue to answer any question that he asked, but I could not act out without risking hurting my case. And it's really sad to me that we all strive to be a perfect victim when really the perfect victim is a myth that does not exist. I think when you are assaulted, you try and assign reasons why you are to blame. You say, well, maybe if I was a little more well-behaved or exhibited self-restraint or was more responsible or more sober, then this wouldn't have happened. When really, the perfect victim does not exist, that whoever is assaulted, even a child, we find ways to assign blame.
Yeah, so you very much felt like you were the one on trial.
Oh, yes.
And that really came through in the lines of questioning as well about what, how much you'd been drinking, what you were wearing, and also the defense's arguments that, as you point out, that boys simply can't help themselves to some extent, and boys will be boys.
Yeah, a lot of the interrogation felt meaningless and a little bit ridiculous. I know so many guys who, if they see an incapacitated female, they know to get her to a safe place or help get her to sleep or give her water. I know guys who get drunk and don't inappropriately touch people. And so if we know that that is possible and know that that is an option, I don't understand why we lower our expectations for standards of behavior and make excuses for people who don't know how to treat other human beings decently.
And not only that, but you had an example of two men who stopped the assault, the two Swedish men on their bicycles who tackled him and which also illuminated to you that Turner was aware that what he did was wrong.
Yes. Running exhibits consciousness of guilt. He did not want to be caught. Unfortunately for him, Peter was too fast and also somehow knows how to do a leg sweep and was able to tackle him. But it's so beautiful to me, the clarity with which they recognized right from wrong so instantly, that they knew what to do immediately, that they recognized that it was not okay what was happening and that they would do whatever they needed to put a stop to it. And, you know, as the two of them were mounted on top of him, pinning him to the ground, they were yelling at him, "Do you think this is okay? Say sorry to her." But to not only stop him, but also demand an apology for me, all in that moment, it's a moment I always go back to that has sustained me throughout this entire process.
Is that part of what you mean when you called what happened to you almost the best case scenario?
For best case scenario, I think it's really disturbing to me that I am in the smallest percentage that gets a conviction, but that I was barely getting through it, even with all of the evidence and resources and support that I had, that I felt completely stripped down and debased continually. We just can't make that routine. We can't expect everyone to go through this process. It was terrifying to me that this is considered a solid case, and yet I am crawling through it just to get by.
What would justice have felt like? It was a 6-month county jail sentence. He served 3 of it. What would justice have felt like to you?
You know, in the beginning, when I learned that he had been caught, I thought this would be very simple. That if you're caught doing something, you apologize for what you did because you know you cannot wiggle out of the situation. So I was expecting some acknowledgement of what happened, that he would announce his accountability and say sorry for the harm he did. And I was prepared to accept that apology in the very beginning. I believe that people can learn, but only if they confront their own behavior and recognize the harm and effect they have on others. But until they do that, they cannot move on. So ideally, that would have happened in the very beginning. I would have said, "Thank you, never do this again." And if he understood that, you know, I believe we both could have moved on. But instead, he pushed back and pushed back for the next 3.5 years.
Did you read the New York Times piece that was headlined, "Why It Matters That Emily Doe Is Asian American"? And essentially what the writer was positing here was that the role of your identity as Asian American affected the way you were treated by the legal system. Do you think you were treated differently because of your race?
I think I was definitely underestimated, and that I was likely to be perceived as passive or more submissive, that they believed I was less likely to retaliate or make noise if I was sort of put aside. I do think women of color slip through the cracks in these systems, that violence against us is more likely to go unnoticed, that it is deemed less serious and important and not as urgent.
We're talking with Chanel Miller, a sexual assault survivor whose testimony at the sentencing hearing of her attacker went viral 3 years ago. Then she was Emily Doe. Today she is making sure we know who she is in a new memoir titled Know My Name. And Chanel Miller, I want to talk to you about that victim impact statement. It was one that ended up going completely viral after you released it. I think it was posted on BuzzFeed. It was translated into multiple languages, read on the floor of Congress. What was your reaction to seeing your words fly?
Unbelievable and completely surreal. Throughout the court process, you know, my family was there to support me, but over time, as the verbal abuse continued in court, I became deaf to hearing that support and that love, and thinking it was coming from a place of pity or sympathy, but that it was not genuine. Like when my parents would say they were proud of me, I didn't understand how that could be possible, because that's not the light I saw myself in, and that's not how I felt when I was on the stand. When the statement was released, so much of that feedback I got saying that I was courageous and outspoken and brave and raw and honest and open and loved, all of that was stunning to me, and I read hundreds of those notes and letters and taught myself to really listen to them and to actually hear what they were telling me and to step back and see how they were seeing me. And I finally realized, like, wow, I've done a big thing. I wrote something that means something, even just to one person. That's so incredible. And they really rescued me from a life where I would have continued with very distorted and negative views of myself. You know, they taught me to see myself in an entirely new light. And I believed them and I felt that. And I still feel that and absorb that. So I'm so grateful for that.
You include so much in your book. But yet I couldn't help wondering what you left out or what was the very hardest thing to include in it.
Yeah, when I started writing, the appeal was still happening. And so every anecdote I included about my life, I felt a need to explain or justify. My writing in the beginning had this really defensive and bitter tone. Like, I was like this, but only because of this. I felt like I was still on the stand and that anything I shared would just be ammunition for them to reopen my case and use against me or to prove why I ultimately deserved to be assaulted. It was really hard for me to open up. So the first draft I wrote strictly around the case, you don't get any more of me. And then my editor said, all right, let's go in and do this again. And now you add characters, which are your family and the people that surround you. And I was very protective of them. And I said, fine, I'll slowly allow you to see them. And over time, I let more and more of myself be shown. And I also learned that I don't have to apologize for the fact that life is messy. So is everybody's. That's what makes me human. And I'm not here to apologize or shrink because of it. I'm growing up just like everybody else. I'm figuring out myself. And, you know, I was taught so much shame, and so much of writing was unlearning that shame and laying it all out on the table. And, you know, honesty is my way of pushing back.
So much shame during the trial and all.
Yes.
Your family has read the book, your parents, your sister?
Yes, yeah.
What has been their response to it?
It was very sweet. My mom, she's reading it slowly, you know, sort of translating some words into Chinese. She would, like, stop me and be like, what's hammered? Why is there a hammer at this party? So my dad ended up reading the book aloud, chapter by chapter, and they would process together and, you know, cry together and then go on a walk. It was very sweet and It means a lot to me when the people you love are willing to go to these emotional places with you, to not turn away from it, to not try and fix it or polish it up, or to say, you know, don't share that. You know, that's too much. People won't like that. They just say, wow. You know, they're sort of in awe of the honesty. And of course, there's that aching of, I wish I could have done more. But I always say, you know, I hope my parents see it as a testimony to how they raised me, to not be ashamed of these feelings, to be able to express them openly, and to have these difficult conversations, that they taught me that that was okay growing up. So I hope they know that.
What was the greatest moment of vulnerability in publishing this book?
Probably the identity reveal. Yeah, I really feared in the beginning that, you know, if I came out, my face would just live next to his face in every article, that I would literally be branded by the limited facts of this case, that I would just be trapped in this grotesque story, that I would never be able to be seen as anything else. So I had to preserve my anonymity and continue to write. And only when the book was completely done and submitted did I sit back and say, I think I'm ready to come forward, because I am emerging as an author. And if you try to keep pushing me into this corner, I have this book that's like my weapon that can show you, you know, who I am. I have this with me now. And only when it was fully completed did I decide to come out.
I think there's a really poignant way that you describe also not wanting to be branded by this person, but also the way that in media reports you were described as Brock Turner's victim, and how you said, I am not his anything.
Yes. Yeah, that apostrophe S indicates ownership, which I wanted to move away from. I also felt like in every article, I'm only mentioned in relation to him. I'm only spoken about in terms of what he did to me, or I'm only talked about in terms of body parts and the state of those body parts. It was so, just dehumanizing. And I wanted to be able to establish myself completely away from him, to not be so closely tied to this stranger. And in writing, I tried to, you know, fill myself out to show you how much color there is and how many, you know, anecdotes I have of my own that have formed me beyond this experience.
When you describe the court process, do you have ideas now that you feel like the courts and the legal system could do better for victims of sexual assault, survivors of assault?
I think, you know, I always say assault is a two-part process. There's the assault and then there's the aftermath. And so much of his or her healing will depend on how she is responded to immediately after. So whoever she discloses the story to in the very beginning has the responsibility to hold that space, to make it non-judgmental, to just say, I hear what you're saying. I'm here for you, and you're safe. To reestablish that comfort, to not begin interrogating her with questions. It's also important to lay out options for moving forward, to not say, you know, I think you should be doing this, or you need to be going to police immediately, because the most important thing is for her to have her sense of agency restored. And I'll just make a note that if you get the rape kit done, it doesn't require that you report, which I think is good to know in terms of collecting evidence.
You began the book by saying, "I am shy." And I was struck by it because you didn't start with, "I was shy."
Yeah.
Do you still consider yourself shy?
Day to day, yeah. I mean, I still am in the back of the exercise class. I don't carry myself loudly, but I also know that I have fire in me, that if you test me or cross my personal boundary, I will say something. And before I question my ability or even my right to speak up for myself, now I know it instantly, and I also know it for others. I won't let other people, you know, disrespect women or victims. I will be there to confront them. I have emerged from this far more assertive and grounded in who I am and what I believe in. So that's different, but I'm still pretty quiet.
You have this beautiful YouTube video that you did of your own drawings, and it finishes with, "I am with you." What are you trying to communicate?
I wanted this book to serve as a companion. I always wandered around sort of lost in my head while I was going through everything and would think about what book I would have wanted to find, what voice I needed to hear. And I wanted the book to fill that space. So even if you feel isolated and you don't feel like you have words for your own feelings yet, if you don't know who to reach out to or how to begin to articulate your own experiences, you have this voice inside the book that's saying, "You are not crazy. I've been there. You know, I've been through those panic attacks and bouts of depression too. But just stay in it. Don't punish yourself for it. Don't, you know, blame yourself for not being stronger or acting happier. Just award yourself for getting through this process and bearing it day by day to figure out how to get back to your life."
Chanel Miller, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Mina Kim. I really loved being here.
Chanel Miller's book is Know My Name. I'm Mina Kim. This is Forum.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.